Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 124, Pontiac's War. Last time, we set up Grenville as Prime Minister in London as Bute fell out of favour, before turning our attention back to North America. We had an overview of the state of America in the years after the capture of Canada, and focused on events in Pennsylvania, as a group of Connecticut settlers attempted to colonize the Wyoming Valley. Just when they seemed to have done it, Tadiasgung was dead, and they could finally begin construction. Word arrived of a huge Indian uprising exploding in the west in an area from the Ohio to northern Michigan, from Susquehanna to the Mississippi. The origins of this conflict are rather interesting. If you think back to our very early episodes on the Native Americans, an idea that we discussed was how Native American history and identity shifted with the arrival of the Europeans. It led to changes in their creation stories. These changes really got underway by the mid-18th century. What started out as preachings against the evils of alcohol soon expanded. In the years before the Seven Years' War, a prophetess in the Wyoming Valley and a few male preachers had a new message: that Indians had been created in separation to other races, and that by turning away from their special path, the Master of Life was punishing them with epidemics. This message was taken up by a fourth prophet, Neolin, among the western Delawares of the Ohio in 1759-1760. Neolin added new ideas, going even further than his predecessors. He argued that the Indians needed to be completely independent from the Euro-Americans, and in order to do that, they needed to abstain from not only alcohol, but all trade. They needed to return to their ancient traditions and relearn how to create their classical weapons in order to defend themselves from the whites in an upcoming war. This was when Amherst's Indian policies started to take effect, prohibiting gifts and the gunpowder trade, as well as the mass increase in westward migration and continual epidemics. This was a startlingly pan-Indian view. You have only to look several episodes ago to the Cherokee War to see how Indians did not cooperate, and the Cree were more than happy to team up with the British to gain an advantage over their northern neighbours. It was also nativist and had political implications, as chiefs who favoured friendly relations with the British lost influence. Neolin's message soon spread, reaching from New York to Minnesota, from the shores of Michigan down the Mississippi to Kentucky. What started amongst the Delawares was now taken up by the Chippewas, Miamis, Ottawas, Potawatomis, Shawnees, and Wyandots, as well as elements of the Iroquois. War belts circulated, and by the winter of 1762-1763, it was now only a question of where and when the fighting would commence. The British could sense that something was wrong, but while the fort commanders checked their supplies, the concern was unable to reach the higher echelons of the chain of command. Even in June 1763, Amherst was reporting that the situation would result in nothing. On April the 27th, 1763, an Ottawa war chief named Pontiac called a war council of the Ottawas, Potawatomis, and Wyandots. We know almost nothing of Pontiac's early life, other than he was probably in his late 40s when he stepped onto the world stage, by calling for an attack on the British garrison at Fort Detroit, although, notably, not the French town outside the walls of the fort. Pontiac led a force of just under 500 warriors against 125 redcoats and 40 traders in a surprise attack on May 7th, which failed, when the British received advanced warning. The fort was placed under siege, and Pontiac intercepted relief efforts, while his own force grew to over 900 by the end of July, when he had the support of six separate nations. Meanwhile, the war expanded. On May 16th, the Wyandots took Fort Sandusky on the western end of Lake Erie. On the 25th, the Potawatomis took Fort St. Joseph, the modern Niles, Michigan, and the Miamis took Fort Miami, now Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the 27th. On June 1st, the Miamis, with support from the Kickapoo, Muskoughton, and we captured Fort Uiaton near Lafayette, Indiana, and on the 2nd, the Chippewas took Fort Michilimackinac, which sits on the straits between Lake Huron and Lake Michigan. On June the 21st, the commander of Fort Edward Augustus, now Green Bay, Wisconsin, turned over the settlement to the Eastern Sioux, who remained friendly with the British. The rebellion continued to spread. In late June, the Senecas, along with the Ottawas and the Chippewas, took every blockhouse way station between Fort Niagara and Pittsburgh. Fort Venango was taken on June 16th, Fort Lebeuf on the 18th, and then Fort Presque Isle on the 21st. Soon enough, the Indians were at Fort Pitt itself. Captain Simeon Akir, the fort's commander, was advised to abandon the fort, but even though it was not the most sturdy construction in the world, and there was a smallpox outbreak, Akir was confident. He had over 300 soldiers and was confident that support would come from Colonel Paquette. He advised the Indians from attacking and presented them with gifts, including smallpox-infected blankets. It had now been 2 months since the war had broken out. Every British settlement to the west of Detroit had fallen to the Indians, and Fort Pitt was braced for attack. Indian raids in Pennsylvania had reached as far east as Carlisle, while Virginia's backcountry was falling apart from the Potomac to North Carolina. Based in New York, Amherst was only beginning to understand what had happened. The British High Command had no understanding of what had happened over the past few years, and saw this as sudden devastation, and the reaction was a dark ruthlessness that students of British imperialism will be all too familiar with. Not knowing that Okoye had already taken this step, Amherst instructed Bouquet to undertake biological warfare in response to Bouquet's messages that the vermin needed to be extirpated. However, to steal a line from Anderson's Crucible of War, appalling as they were, Amherst's orders did not occasion genocide so much as reflect his and his colleagues' genocidal fantasies. For in fact, there was nothing that he or any British officer in America could do to reverse the tide of Indian military success. The British were in a very weak position. Most of the redcoats in North America had already been redirected to the Caribbean, and Amherst knew all too well that the British would not send reinforcements from Europe. This left him with one option: using the provincials. However, this would mean contacting the governors and then having them call their various assemblies, which would all take time. It would be impossible for any military action to take place before the summer of 1764, and he was convinced that only military action would end the conflict, being unable to understand how the war had broken out in the first place. He wrote to Sir William Johnson that he was, quote, determined to go through with the suppression of the rebellion in such a manner that the whole race of Indians who have any connection with the English may see the folly and madness as well as the ingratitude of setting themselves in opposition to a people from whom they have received so many benefits and whose power is such as can in a very short time make the savages feel the utmost extremity of want and render their pretended importance of very little effect. Their punishment must, therefore, be previous to the treating with them, and when that shall happen, all they can expect is forgiveness, and a trade, under proper regulations, opened to them. But as to presents, it would certainly be the highest presumption in them to expect any. Justice they shall have, but no more, for they can never be considered by us as a people to whom we owe regards, and it would be madness, to the highest degree, ever to bestow favours on a race who have so treacherously and without any provocation on our side attacked our posts and butchered our garrisons. Presents should be given only to those who remain our firm friends." End quote. Amherst identified three critical central supply forts that would be used in his operation: Niagara, Detroit, and Pittsburgh. Johnson was then to ensure that the Iroquois isolated the rogue Seneca elements. Then two separate forces were to begin operations. Provincials from New York and New Jersey would move westward from Niagara to Detroit and suppress the tribes of the Great Lakes, while a force from Virginia and Pennsylvania would move into the Ohio. This plan clearly demonstrates Amherst's desire to suppress the Indians, but also shows what he had understood to be the lessons of the Cherokee War. While the Cherokees had done initial damage, they were weakened by winter and loss of ammunition when trade stopped. While the Indians had captured many forts, they lacked the transportation infrastructure to move ammunition where it was needed. However, all of this was surface. What the British continually failed to understand was that British actions were the root of the problem rather than its solution. The tribes of the Great Lakes had long dealt with the French. The French were generally tolerant of Indian culture and were generous of gifts. The governor of New France was referred to as Onontio and was fondly regarded by the Native Americans. While they were aware that Onontio had been defeated, it didn't make sense to them that New France had been destroyed simply by the signing of a piece of paper in Paris, and much of Indian action can be viewed as an attempt to restore New France. The British were aware of this, but because imperialists could not give the Indians agency, they assumed that the French had installed agents provocateurs to instigate the conspiracy. They often viewed the Indians as children who couldn't agree on anything, so there must be some European brains behind the operation, rather than the much simpler solution that British actions, the taking away of gifts and the occupation of Indian lands, had naturally led to a series of loosely coordinated but ultimately independent revolts that shared a common theme of pan-Indianism. This moment, at the end of June 1763, marks a convenient point to end this week's episode, but we'll be back soon enough to continue the story of Pontiac's War as the British scramble to put together an adequate response. Thanks for listening. I will see you next time.